Recorded live.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here. This is, of course, Yahweh's Covenant People on TalkShoe and simulcasting on Eurofolk Radio. And tonight's show is going to be part two of Jesus Was Not a Jew by W.G. Finlay, which is really an outstanding document. I can't recommend it highly enough for anybody who's interested in Christian identity. This is one of the more enlightening documents of Christian identity scholarship. And unfortunately, W.G. Finlay was a Paul basher, but other than that, his teaching, he was a virtual two-seed liner, although he never broached the subject. He was he never talked about that. But he certainly does not believe and never believed in race mixing. So I'm going to pick it up a little bit into where we left off last time. I'm going to repeat a couple of paragraphs here because they are very important. Going back to, it's about the middle of the document, and here, again, this is from Jesus Was Not a Jew by W.G. Finlay from the Anglo-Saxon Israel website. And I'm going to, about the middle of the document, just above the heading, "He shall be called a Nazarene," the paragraph before where he states, "There is absolutely no evidence to suggest that the Adam of Genesis 1:26, simply translated as man in the Authorized Version," and here is where the King James Version makes a tremendous mistake, because it translates various different Hebrew words such as Adam and Enosh and Ish, and those aren't the only three, there are others, that the King James all are translated as man, making no distinction among the different words and therefore species that are implied in the Hebrew. So this is a major defect in the King James Version, otherwise called the Authorized Version. Very important that W.G. Finlay is bringing this fact out, that this is, again, simply translated as man. Therefore, you don't get the specificity of the fact that there are different breeds, there are different races, there are different ethnicities that the King James calls man, but the Bible, the Hebrew, only refers to Adam kind as M-A-N, man. And that's a major distinction. So, therefore, we in identity refer to ourselves as Adam kind and the rest of the species as humankind or as beasts of the field. Now, let's continue. Whereas in Genesis 2 was certainly given the law, that is, Adam and Eve were given specific, hard to say whether they were given the whole law, but they were certainly given the law of non-race mixing, because that's what the trees in Genesis are. They are trees that have the knowledge of good and evil, and oaks and elms don't have knowledge of good and evil. We're talking about two-legged trees here. We're talking about genetics is what we're talking about here. The tree of life being the line of descent of Adam and Eve before they fell, and the other trees in the garden that were non-Adamic trees. And that's the problem, because the non-Adamic trees did have knowledge of evil and possibly some knowledge of good and evil. But when Adam and Eve mixed with these other species, especially with the Nachash, the fallen one, their offspring became mixed with the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And otherwise, we would have been pure good. Only good could have resulted from the offspring of Adam and Eve had they not sinned. In any case, let's continue here. having transgressed the law of God, and he's very right that there was a law given to Adam and Eve. He said, thou shalt not touch that tree of knowledge of good and evil, should not even touch it. An act which gave rise to the expression sin, 1 John 3:4, it became necessary that propitiation be made for this. Hence the angel's statement, he shall save his people from their sins. The family line is thus clear and unmistakable and cannot be equated with contention of universal man. That's exactly right. That only Adam kind is being talked about here in the line of descent from Adam and Eve. Not talking about the so-called universal man, which would be Ish in any case. It wouldn't be Adam kind. Okay, this heading at the center of the article. He shall be called a Nazarene. In Matthew 2:33, which deals with the sequel to the death of Herod, who had ordered the massacre of all children under the age of 2 years, it will be noted that Joseph, having sought safety in Egypt, now decided to return home. Quote, and he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the prophets, by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. Who is he? Well, Messiah. While this statement positively disassociates Jesus of Nazareth from the Jews, it creates a problem which can only be solved by considering the Hebrew and Greek text once again. Now, of course, we make a distinction between Judahites and Judeans, and it is specifically the Edomite Judeans that we refer to as Jews, because they're of mixed race. The Judahites of Judea were of either the tribe of Judah or of the house of Judah, with a little bit of Benjamin and Levi mixed in. And those people in Judah, in the land of Judah, having returned from Babylon after the 70 years punishment, they instituted a golden age of the law, which excluded non-Israelites from the territory. And in fact, the Maccabees had a series of wars, first with the Greeks, then with the Romans, and with Edomites, Ammonites, Arabs, and others, whom they felt were their enemies and were always trying to remain separate from all those people. So until the advent of John Hyrcanus, who conquered the Edomites and then began circumcising them and bringing them into the nation, now called henceforward Judea, because it was a mixed-race nation, no longer called Judah. That's how we transitioned from Judah to Judea. Nevertheless, there were all kinds of pure-blooded Judahites who refused to mix with Edomites still living in Judea. The problem was that Herod, with the help of the Roman army, invaded Judah and took over by force, killed the descendants of the house of Maccabees, and put his own stooges in as high priests, therefore displacing the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, with Edomite Jews. And so this is a huge difference. I'm not sure whether W.G. Finlay has this understanding that there were two different types of Judeans, the pure-blooded Judahites and the Edomite Jews, who were enemies, while, of course, the Jews were pretending to be Judah, were pretending to be the kinsmen of Judah, just as the Jews do today in all the countries that they inhabit. In America, the Jews pretend to be Americans. In Germany, the Jews pretend to be Germans. In Sweden, the Jews pretend to be Swedes, etc., etc., etc. In every one of these countries, the Jews are imposters and impersonators, fooling, and then in addition, they pretend to be Judah and or Israel. So in those days, it was a much easier to tell, because the purebred Judahites could easily see the difference between themselves and these Edomite Jews. And the women of Judah protested daily against Herod, saying that this guy Herod is not one of our people. He has been installed here by force by the Romans, and we don't want him. Please get rid of this guy. Okay? This is recorded in Josephus. The idea that Herod was a Judahite is absolutely false, or an Israelite is absolutely false. He was not. He was an Edomite. And the Pharisees under Herod were Edomites, and they're the ones that created the religion we know today as Judaism. So Finlay is here making it, trying to make a distinction between Jesus, that is Yahshua Messiah, and those who dwelt in Judea because he was a Nazarene. However, we just went through the fact that Yahshua was a descendant of Mary, who was a Judahite, and his stepfather was Joseph, who was also a Judahite. So it's very clear that Jesus was not just a Nazarene, he was a Judahite. He just was called a Nazarene because that's where he dwelt. So let's continue. While this statement positively dissociates Jesus of Nazareth from the Jews, that is the Jews of Judea, but not from the Judahites of Judea, it creates a problem which can only be solved by considering the Hebrew and Greek texts once again. The fallacy of the statement, Jesus the Jew, will become obvious as the subject of Nazareth is explored, and the first step in this direction is the consideration of the word Nazareth itself. Now, we talked about the fact that the Nazarites were a sect of Israelites in the Old Testament. Let's see what he has to say here. The first point which strikes one is that nowhere in the Old Testament does this name appear, which immediately brings into question the authenticity of the statement, he shall be called a Nazarene. If no such place existed in the Old Testament, how could the prophets write about it? The Hebrew root which developed into the name Nazareth was Netzer, which literally means a branch. And this word is found in the Old Testament and is associated with the situation arising out of Israel's transgression of God's holy law. It will be recalled that through Solomon's transgression of the law, the 12-tribe Israel kingdom was divided into two sections. 1 Kings 12:16-20. The majority northern kingdom became subject to successive waves of Assyrian invasions until finally, in 721 BC, its capital Samaria was finally taken. If one follows the history of these invasions and notes the degree of impact that these made, it will be noted that while the territory of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali in the region of the Sea of Galilee were afflicted, there is absolutely nothing to suggest that all the people of these tribes were taken into captivity, as were the Ephraimites of Samaria. And so I would say most of the 12 or 10 tribes of the northern house were taken. The vast majority were indeed taken. However, there were some exceptions. He says, if one follows the history of these invasions and notes the degree of impact these made, it will be noted that while the territory of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali in the region of the Sea of Galilee were afflicted, there is absolutely nothing to suggest that all the people of these tribes were taken into captivity. So, we're talking that were many of Zebulun and Naphtali were left. Isaiah, who wrote during the period when the Assyrian invasions were taking place, wrote of God's intention to bring the northern kingdom to an end, but in the process, some would be left in the land in the northern regions and away from the center of activity, as it were. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. It should be noted that nothing is said of making it disappear altogether. And it shall be as when the harvestman gathereth his corn, and reapeth the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. Well, of course, these can't be Jews because the Jews don't farm. We're speaking of Israelites here. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel. That's Isaiah 17:4 through 6. These fruitful branches are written of as para netzer, the word para being dropped, and the people and land simply being known as netzer, which eventually developed into the word Nazareth. One may therefore see in the name Nazareth an association with those in Israel who were not taken into the Assyrian captivity and who remained in their land despite the changes which were taking place in the territory of their brethren in the south. While the word Netzer applied to those Israelites who were the branches of the uppermost bough of Jacob, Isaiah made reference to another Netzer. Quote, "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots," Isaiah 11:1. The association of this branch, which came from the stem of Jesse, and those branches of Jacob which had been left in the land, was unmistakable, for in John 1:11 it is stated that he came unto his own, and his own received him not. While in Matthew 13:54, his own is qualified as the people of Nazareth. I would say his own also includes, and particularly includes, all the people of Judah and Benjamin, not just the people of Nazareth, because the fact is that the vast majority of Israelites in Judea and in Benjamin, otherwise known as Galilee, the vast majority of these Israelites really did not understand who Jesus was. They did not understand that he was Messiah. Only a few people of the Israelites there actually appreciated this fact. In fact, even the apostles were scratching their heads. Who is this guy? What's he doing here? Etc., etc., etc. Okay, there's a troll in there. I have to get rid of this troll. Okay, so what we're seeing here is he came unto his own. Who were his own? The Israelites, primarily the house of Judah, not just those living in Nazareth. And when he was come into his own country, he taught them in their synagogues, and they were offended in him. But Jesus said unto them, "A prophet is not without honor, save in his own country and in his own house." Now it is true that when he started his ministry, he started his ministry in the synagogue at Capernaum, which was up in Galilee among the Benjamites. And that's where he quoted Isaiah as if referring to himself. And after he finished quoting Isaiah, he closed the book and said to the people gathered there, the Israelites gathered there, "I am he. I am the one that these verses speak of." At which point, the congregation arose and chased Jesus out of the synagogue and tried to throw him off a cliff. So, I think this is what Finlay is talking about, that the Nazarenes did not accept him, but neither did the vast majority of Judahites and Israelites. It took quite a long time for the Israelites to understand what had happened. The crucifixion, it all just kind of flew by. It was just current news. And his ministry, a very brief ministry, only 3.5 years, was over and done with before the Israelites really appreciated who he was. And as I said, even the apostles were confused and did not understand what was going on. Nevertheless, it's obvious that he came for Israel, for his covenant was only, Yahweh's covenant was only with the Israelites and with no other people. And the book of Luke constantly refers to Yahshua coming to his people Israel and not for the whole world. Okay, so after he says a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and in his own house, realizing that he was offended, or his people were offended in him, but not just in Nazareth, all over the land of Judea and Galilee. In this, one may see that he was indeed a Nazarene, in the first instance, the branch among the branches of Jacob, and secondly, a Nazarene because he lived and taught there except when it was necessary for him to visit the Judean capital of Jerusalem. Now, it's important to point out here that Yahshua very rarely went to Judea and or Jerusalem. He went there, I think, annually for the Feast of Tabernacles. It may have been another feast. I may be wrong about the exact feast, but he went there on a particular feast every year. So, as far as I understand, he only went to Jerusalem three times during his ministry. And the first time was right after the synagogue speech at Capernaum. And what he did was he went down to the temple in Jerusalem. He fashioned a cat of nine tails, and he started whipping the banksters out of the temple. So he did this three times, not just once. He did this three times. And every time, it was like for him, it was a chore to have to go down to Jerusalem. Why? Because he knew that the Jews were down there. The Jews who wanted to kill him were down there. And so wherever he went, these Jews followed him around. Even they even pursued him up in Galilee and in Nazareth. And wherever he went, these Jewish Pharisees, these Edomite Jewish Pharisees, followed him around, questioning him, trying to catch him in a statement by which he could be prosecuted. And all four Gospels contain the evidence that this is exactly what these Edomite Jewish Pharisees were trying to do the whole time that he walked the earth. Judea and its inhabitants, having seen that Nazareth in Galilee was peopled by the descendants of those true Israelites who had escaped the deportation by the Assyrians, attention is now focused on the minority section of the 12 tribes, the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. The Babylonians, who succeeded the Assyrians as the then world power, devastated the land occupied by the two remaining tribes and took them into captivity, where they languished for the 70-year duration of the empire's existence. Very good. And it's amazing how few Judeo-Christians or modern Christians have any knowledge whatsoever of these deportations and captivities. But it's obvious here that identity scholarship knows this period of history very well, and W.G. Finlay is bringing it to light right here. During this time, nomadic people took possession of the land, Ezekiel 32:33-24, and there is no means whereby they can be identified except to note that they were not of the family of Abraham, for they stated, Abraham was one, and he inherited the land, but we are many. The land is given us for an inheritance. By whom? By the Assyrians. When, under the decree of Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king, a remnant of the Babylonian captivity returned to rebuild Jerusalem, Ezra 1:2, certain adversaries were drawn to the work, which again suggests that another unnamed element was present in the land. Now, it was precisely in the book of Ezra, I believe it's chapter 4, we are told that Ezra the priest was accosted by certain Samaritans who wanted to assist in the building of the temple and rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and the streets, etc. But Ezra told them, no, we don't want your help. We don't associate with Samaritans. again proving the exclusivity of the Judahites, who refused to intermingle with the Samaritans and the other non-Israelite people around there. They certainly would associate with Benjamites and with Levites, and they certainly would have associated with the two tribes that were left up in northern territories, but they weren't traveling down to Jerusalem for any great purposes. So what we're seeing here is Zebulun and Naphtali were way up north, and they remained there and rarely came down to Judea. They had very little business there. And there's a prophecy in the Old Testament, also in Isaiah, that these two tribes, Zebulun and Naphtali, would see a great light, which means it's a prophecy that Yahshua Messiah would be there and they would see him. So all this fits perfectly, and it was fulfilled by Jesus the man. So under the decree of Cyrus, the Judahites, Benjamites, and some Levites returned from Babylon, reinstituted the Mosaic law, began observing the feast days and the Hebrew calendar, etc., etc. This is why I refer to it as a golden age of the Mosaic law under Ezra and Nehemiah. So, when the work of reconstruction was completed, it was evident that the remnant of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, which had returned from Babylon, were a minority population group, for Ezra recounts that the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites were also in the land. Ezra 9:1. If one considers how relatively small the territory was, and the wide diversity of people who subsequently took up residence there, one can appreciate something of the story of the land, which came to be known as Judea. It is not known who coined the name Judea, but it is known that the territory so named comprised an area some 55 miles from north to south and from 25 to 30 miles in width. It has been suggested that the name was derived from Judah, which could have been the case. But to call the whole population by the name of a small portion of a remnant of the tribe of Judah, which returned, would have been as ludicrous as suggesting that South Africans are part of and parcel of the general term African. The name Judea was a territorial and not a racial or tribal one, and when it is considered that the modern English word Jew is derived from the historical Judea, it will be seen that a geographical and not a racial term has been perpetuated. That is absolutely correct. The northern boundary of Judea certainly did not take in Galilee, nor did it cover the people living there. Because why? Because Samaria was in between. And the descendants of the Samaritans, which are composed of the various ethnicities that he just named, they're the ones who remained in Samaria. And for some reason, the Benjaminites got separated from the Judahites with Samaria in between. That, I don't know if anybody's ever done an article explaining how that happened, but it did happen. Why the Benjamites would go north to the north of Samaria. But that is what happened. The northern boundary of Judea certainly did not take in Galilee, and nor did it cover the people living there, the difference being so great that even the dialect spoken in the north differed from the Judeans. It was from the Galileans that the Lord Jesus Christ selected his disciples, and on the occasion of calling Nathanael, it will be noted how far the Pharisaic propaganda had penetrated it. It will be recalled that the Hebrew Netzer, which covered the true Israelites who had been left in the land and who had never been associated with the population of Judea, finally developed into Nazareth. Facts which were certainly known to the hierarchy which are now controlled Judea, and that would be the Edomite Jews. In typical vein, they coined an expression based on the identity of the people, which was contrasted with their own heterogeneous origins. Well, by heterogeneous, he can only mean Edomite. Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? John 1:46. Here, without a shadow of a doubt, is the work of the anti-God conspiracy in which David's time had raised its head and had proclaimed its mission at the demise of Israel, Psalm 83:1-4. The remnant of true Israel, the uppermost branches, were in Nazareth, while the cosmopolitan Judeans were claiming to be God's chosen people. All right, so here we have this mixed race people called Edomite Jews having started to call themselves God's chosen people, Israel. It is small wonder then that they, the counterfeit, engendered a complex within the Nazarenes. Can there anything good come out of Nazareth? Of course, the Jews do this to us today. There, see, the Jews become the number one citizens of whatever country they infest, and they proceed to demean the indigenous people. That's what happened. That's how the Jews demeaned the Judahites. Of course, the Judahites were part and parcel of the, how should I put this, the degeneration of the Mosaic Law in the 100 years. It was John Hyrcanus who began the degeneration. It was his fault. He never should have circumcised Edomites. But by that act, he created a multicultural state. Now we see today on the world stage exactly the same thing happening in every formerly white Christian country in the world. We have Judeo-Christians taking the place of true Christians, and we have race mixing with the Muslim invasion, black invasion, Hindu invasion, you name it, of our countries taking place on a wholesale basis. In fact, just before today's show, I got a call from an old friend. Her name is Ann, lives on the south side of Chicago. Very Catholic side of Chicago. Whole south side of Chicago is very Catholic, with Poles and Germans and Italians, etc., living there. And she reminded me that in 1980, I predicted that America is going to suffer from a major race war. And she just called me up to remind me that I had made that prediction and how right I was. I said, thank you very much, Ann. Yes, I've been teaching this since 1980. It's finally coming true. So here we are in the midst of this utter collapse of civilization, thanks to the Jews having taken over our various white nations. Let's continue here. Despite the fact that he had categorically stated that they, the Jews, were not of God, John 8:47. That, and they were not my sheep, John 10:26. Despite this, there are still those who persist in identifying him as a Jew. The subject of the inscription on the cross is a very poor basis for identification, for apart from it being an English translation, and incorrectly translated at that, it might surprise many people to realize that the inscription was changed 3 times. During the period of the crucifixion. All that is necessary to confirm something surrounding the confusion created by the inscription is to study the gospel accounts again and note the series of events as they are related in the 4 gospels. Now here again, we have critics of the Bible saying, well, you know, Luke says this, Mark says that, John says this, and they don't agree with each other, therefore the Bible is false. No. The inscription was changed. It was changed twice. Oh, man. Guest 11 is another troll. He came and went. But, folks, this is great stuff. And this inscription is what's used by many Judeo-Christians as quote-unquote proof that Jesus was a Jew. No, it's not. As must be obvious, the inscription is a title, And as Mark's account is merely the conventional accusation which accompanied the convicted to his punishment, this account can be left out of the story. In John 19:19, it will be noted that Pilate wrote a title, which was written in Hebrew, an inscription for the cross. Yeah, thank you very much. It probably is Skip Baker. And Greek, a title which was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, and being a Roman, the Latin would rightly express the title which Pilate intended to convey. In Latin, this title read, Jesus Nazarenus Rex Iudaeorum, I-N-R-I, in Latin. And an accurate English translation of this is, Jesus the Nazarene, ruler of the Judeans, which, far from making him a Judean, establishes him as a Nazarene, which is obviously not a Judean. Makes sense to me. But, of course, the Judeo-Christians overlooked this, okay? So, Jesus the Nazarene. But if, and the title is Judeans, Judeos, Greek. If it had been a translation from the Hebrew, it could only have been accurately stated as Jesus Nazarenus Rex. Oh, gee, what would it be? I'm sorry, I can't do it. I can't translate it into the Latin because Iudaeorum. It'd be Judah. Judah is the only word it could be substituted accurately. Jesus the Nazarene, ruler of Judah, and of course, by extension, all of Israel, because he was of the house of Judah. He was not a Judean in the multicultural sense. He was of the house of Judah. Okay, so this establishes him as a Nazarene, which is obviously not a Judean, but nevertheless, he was a Judahite. There is, of course, no modern English development for the word Nazarene, as there has been for the word Judean. But had there been, the gulf between the Lord Jesus Christ and the Jews would have been emphasized more than it is in the original languages. But I would say here, even though this is a good point, I would say the more important point is the fact that there's a huge difference. There is an ethnic and cultural and racial difference between Judahites and Edomite Jews or Edomite Judeans, a huge difference between those two cultural ethnicities. The Judahites being direct descendants of Judah and the Edomite Judeans being direct descendants of Cain, Canaan, and Esau Edom. In fact, Idumea was the name of the country just to the south of Judah where these Edomites dwelt, and it was clearly understood by all Judahites that these Edomites were the enemies of Israel and not to be considered Israelites in any way, shape, or form. Yet today's people, today's scholars, of course the Jews themselves, insist that they are Israel when they're not. He says, be all this as it may, the next point to note is the argument which developed between the chief priests and Pilate concerning what had been written, this argument being recorded in verses 21 and 22 of John 19. If this account is read, it will be seen that the original writing and the argument took place before the parting of the Lord's garments, John 19:23, and although John does not record the outcome of the controversy, Matthew picks up the story and relates that they set up his title after they had parted his garments. And this would also be a fulfillment of prophecy, that they would have cast lots for his garments. A title which had removed the reference to his identity as a Nazarene. There is no evidence in Matthew's account to suggest that this title, which was set up after they had parted the Lord's garments, was in the three languages, which the original had been written in before it left Pilate's presence. Well, I don't think so. I mean, the fact that they parted his garments would not be an important statement. What Pilate wrote, and had nothing to do with his garments. It had to do with who he was or who the people of Judea perceived him to be. That's what Pilate's statement was all about. As he makes no mention of languages, only the title, one wonders if the chief priests had second thoughts about deliberately changing what Pilate had written, and it is quite conceivable that they believed he would send someone to investigate the inscription. If the inscription contained only one language, as is suggested by Matthew's account, there could be repercussions from Pilate, and so a third inscription appeared, and it will be noted that this took place at about the sixth hour when darkness began to fall, and this inscription was written in Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. A reversal of the order of languages as it had been originally written by Pilate. In the dark, three languages could be seen, and any investigator would not take the trouble to note that the order had been reversed. He would not see, too, that the Nazarene identity of Jesus had been removed. Okay, so somebody messed with the inscription. All of which goes to point that that inscription is not reliable as an identification of Jesus as a Jew. This is the point that W.G. Finley is obviously making. The duplicity of the chief priests in the matter of the inscription placed over the Lord is reflected by those today who take whatever account happens to suit them in their insistence that Jesus of Nazareth was indeed a Jew. They fail, too, to appreciate that in the English translations they are dealing with interpretations of men. Interpretations which have been... Hold on, I have to unplug the phone. Excuse me one second. Okay, so that... where was I here? They fail. The irony of the modern situation is that if Christ came today as he came at the first advent, he would be hounded as a racist. I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel, Matthew 15:24. He would be castigated as anti-Semitic. Ye, the Jews, are of your father the devil, John 8:44. And he would be accused of violating human rights by limiting his disciples' activity to one people alone, Matthew 10:6. It is indeed small wonder that in the preview of his second advent, the Lord Jesus Christ related that his identity would be an enigma, for his name, the Word of God, would be unknown among men. Today, while men seek to mold him in conformity with their own ideas, to make him a Jew, a black, a colored, I think in South Africa, a colored is a mixed person, a half-breed, or whatever shade of breed, or simply universal man. He awaits the time when he will take the throne of his father David, Luke 1:32, when he shall rule over the house of Jacob, Luke 1:33, and when his influence shall spread among his people and his government shall bring order into a totally disorganized world. And man, are we disorganized today! It can't get much more disorganized than it is right now. Everything is collapsing. The economy is utterly collapsing. Businesses, I think several major businesses, national chains are closing. Japan lowered its interest rate to less than zero, because they can't even give their money away. The economy is so poor, nobody's even borrowing money to start businesses. Amazing. Japan lowered its interest rate to below zero. It's unheard of. But this is what's happening. And of course, need I mention the rape fest going on in Europe, and the flash mobs and anti-white attacks going on all over the world, with the Jews empowering Muslims and all non-whites against us. Folks, this is what we get for trying to appease the non-white world, for trying to bring them into the fold of true Christianity. Cannot be done, because our Christian brethren, our Judeo-Christian brethren, have failed to heed the warnings of the Old Testament, wherein Yahweh used the very people we race mix with to destroy us, which is happening today. And there was no commandment to go and preach the gospel to all the world in order to convert them. There is no, in fact, the gospels are very clear that if somebody is not inclined to hear the word, shake the dust off your feet and go to the next person. And even there, it was only talking about Israelites, Israelite homes. There is no commandment to go out and try to convert the entire planet into Christianity. And the only thing I can say here is that that has failed miserably. It has absolutely failed miserably. Not only has the Christian clergy, the Judeo-Christian clergy, failed to convert the rest of the world to Christianity, the clergy has been converted to Islam, or should I say Chrislam, and any other pagan, neo-pagan doctrine that is now being preached from the Judeo-Christian pulpits. Talk about failure. Absolute failure is the, well, let's call it the epitaph of Judeo-Christianity. On the grave marker of Judeo-Christianity, it will state absolute failure. Okay. In other words, there is no such thing as a universal gospel. He awaits the time when he will take the throne of his father David, when he shall rule over the house of Jacob, and when his influence shall spread among his people, and his government shall bring order into a totally disorganized world. And of course, the Old Testament prophesies that he will come to create a government. And a government has laws and rule of law. He shall rule with a rod of iron, and there won't be any of these mamby-pamby Christians waiting around, these antinomians and universalists. They won't be around because they will be gathered up with the tares. It is at this time that the deluded world will be startled by the identity of this man of Nazareth as a son of the living God, or as a white Israelite. W.J. Finlay's, okay, this is my comment here. Last sentence brings to mind Paul's prophecy in Romans 9:26, "And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there they shall be called the children of the living God." And of course, the Judeo-Christians have no idea what this prophecy means. It's actually a quotation from the Old Testament where it says, and it is only fulfilled by us because we, the Caucasian Israelites of the world, and those of us who claim in identity to be Israel are laughed at. And the whole world is telling us, you can't be Israel because the Jews are Israel. Well, sorry to tell you, the Jews aren't Israel. We are. The meaning of this prophecy is as follows. Since the 12 tribes became scattered into the wilderness of Europe, and because they gradually lost awareness due to centuries of migration and resettlement of their descent from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the world began to refer to them, the Caucasian Israelites, as not Israel. As Mr. Finlay points out, the Edomite Jews of Judea began asserting that they, the Judeans of Edomite descent, were the Israel of God. This was the beginning of the great impersonation of Israel by the Jews. This great impersonation has been deceiving the whole world, Revelation 12:9, for the last 2,000 years. It is only now, in these end times, that the Christian Identity Movement, which is a movement exclusive to the Caucasian Israelites, God's chosen people, that we are waking up to our Israelite heritage and asserting it publicly. Even secular historians are beginning to see that the Jews are imposters and that we Caucasian Israelites, who thanks to a combination of Jewish deceit and our own national amnesia, have been understandably seen as not my people, but in fact are the sons of the living God. It is only a question of time before the whole world acknowledges this fact. See also Revelation 3:9 and 2:9. So that concludes our discussion of W.G. Finlay's article, Jesus Was Not a Jew. Now, of course, he approaches it from the fact that Jesus was a Nazarene and does not talk about him being a descendant, although he does mention the fact that Mary was a Judahite and that his stepfather Joseph was a Judahite. So, but he doesn't dwell on that subject, preferring to identify Yahshua as a Nazarene. So, of course, Nazareth was a city of the Benjaminites, and so therefore, in any case, he was an Israelite. He was a Judahite living in the territory of the Benjamites in the city of Nazareth. That's where he grew up, having been born in Bethlehem. And then in his later years, after returning from the attempt by Herod to kill the baby Jesus, whenever they came back from Egypt, they settled in Nazareth, probably as far away from Jerusalem as they probably possibly could. And of course, Joseph, I was going to say of course, but I'm not sure if Joseph himself was from Nazareth, but he's probably a Bethlehemite. So what we're seeing here is a confirmation of several prophecies, many prophecies that W.G. Finlay could have pointed out from the Old Testament that only one person has ever fulfilled, and that Zebulun and Naphtali would see a great light, which means they would see the Messiah walking within their territory and among their people. So now to confirm that the Jews cannot possibly be Israel, Revelation chapter 2, verse 9, I know your works and tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. Now, of course, these words are written to Israel, and they're dictated to John by Yahshua Messiah. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews or say they are Judahites and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. So it's obviously stating here that there is a group of people in the world that claim to be Judah, are not, and are the synagogue of Satan. Revelation 3, verse 9. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which Yahshua identified who they are, synagogue of Satan, in John chapter 8, verses 32 through 44. You are the children of the devil, and the lusts of your father will ye do. I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Judahites, and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. This is quoting from Isaiah 60:14. Again, these words are spoken to Israel, not to the Jews. And it's telling us that these Jews will ultimately recognize us as Yahweh's chosen people, Israel. And they will come down and worship at our feet. That's what this verse is saying. Does not mean they will convert to Christianity. They will simply recognize before they are judged, and I think this is the best they can possibly do, is to acknowledge that they are not Israel and that we are, and hopefully they will get a lesser judgment by making this acknowledgement. But there's no way the Jews are going to convert to Christianity. It's not in their blood. They have within their veins the blood of Nahash, the agent of Satan, who seduced Eve and brought forth Cain, The Jews are literally devils in shoe leather, and they contain that DNA of Cain, which Matthew chapter 23 totally explains, and which I will quote now. It is unmistakable. There is no other possible way of interpreting Matthew chapter 23 at the very end, where Yahshua, Messiah, explains who they are. Matthew chapter 23, verse 33. Actually, let me go before that, because he is talking, addressing the Pharisees in verse 29, and we know these Pharisees are Edomite Jews. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. In other words, they built the tombs before they even killed them in preparation for their death, just like they planned 9/11 and then built a monument. They had that monument planned even before the two buildings came down. Verse 30, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Again, this he's saying, you're liars. You would be saying this as hypocrites. Wherefore, you be witnesses to yourselves that you are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill up. Now, this is, there's nothing here about, you know, spiritual children. He's telling them they are the literal descendants, the literal blood descendants of those who killed the prophets. Verse 32. Fill you up then the measure of your fathers. Not spiritual fathers, literal fathers. You serpents, you generation of vipers, just like John 8:44. Race, you race of vipers is the proper translation here. How can you escape the damnation of hell? Wherefore, behold, I send to you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify, which included himself, and some of them shall you scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city. Who has been chasing us around, persecuting us? Verse 35, that upon you, you scribes and Pharisees, you Edomite Jews, may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. There's nothing spiritual about this passage. Yahshua is saying that you Jews have murdered all these people, from Abel down to Zechariah, who was a contemporary of the Messiah. It is impossible for him to be making this accusation against just the group standing before him, because they weren't alive when Cain murdered Abel. He's impugning their entire race. He is accusing their entire race. You race of vipers. Verily I say to you, all these things shall come upon this race. And we know that they are the tares of Matthew chapter 13. So, thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh, Pass the Ammunition, a great article by W.G. Finlay. And next week I'll pick another article by the same title, Jesus Was Not a Jew, from Anglo-Saxon Israel, and we'll discuss that. And thanks for listening, and we hope to shed more light on the fact that Jesus was not a Jew next time. Take care. Yahweh bless. Good day.
Call recording has been completed.